Welcome to Two-Way Street. Watching the massive media coverage of the Iowa caucuses and the excitement generated as the results came in the other night, I couldn't help but think about the two men who were largely responsible for taking the caucuses out of obscurity and making Iowa a crucial state in the presidential nominating process. They were Jimmy Carter and Hamilton Jerden. Here's the story. Jerden was an Albany native who worked for Carter's 1970 gubernatorial campaign. When Carter won, he kept Jerden on as his executive secretary. But Jerden had higher ambitions for his boss.
Before I finished my second year in office as governor, he came into my office one day and he said, "Governor, I want to talk to you about your future." And I said, "Go ahead, Ham." He said, "You know, you can't run for a second term. I said, "I know the Georgia Constitution as well as you do. I just have one term." He said, "You know, you can't beat Herman Talmadge in a race for the U.S. Senate." And I said, "Okay, maybe not, but so what?" He said, "I think you ought to run for national office." And I said, "Which one?" And he said, "There ain't but one."
Carter was no shrinking violet. He liked the idea and turned Jerden loose.
Hamilton devised a strategy that became famous to solve one of the most intricate political riddles on earth. How do you get a Georgia peanut farmer elected president of the United States of America? We did what Hamilton said, and we went to the White House together.
Jerden was a true political visionary. He mapped out a now legendary 72-page blueprint for how an obscure Georgia governor could rise to the White House. And it all started with the 1976 Iowa caucuses. Iowa had never loomed large in the eyes of presidential contenders before then, but Jerden and Carter saw it as a place where Carter could establish himself as a contender. It cost little to run a campaign in Iowa. Carter was a farmer and could relate to Iowa's large farm population, and since few candidates traveled to Iowa to compete, Carter could dominate the media coverage of the state. On the night of the caucuses, when Carter finished at the head of the Democratic field, the first step in his march to the White House had been realized.
Here are the first political returns for the year 1976. Yesterday, about 50,000 Democrats in Iowa met in caucuses in homes, churches, and firehouses to choose delegates for their state party convention. Most of them are still uncommitted, 37%. But former Georgia Governor Jimmy Carter did extremely well with 27% of the delegate preferences, more than twice as many as Indiana Senator Birch Bayh and three times as many as Fred Harris, the former Oklahoma senator. Charles Quinn covered the Iowa caucuses for us, and here he is to tell us how they worked.
The candidates were really not after delegates here in Iowa. What the candidates were after was a boost, some momentum, to carry them into the primary battles ahead. And a big boost is exactly what Jimmy Carter got here. Charles Quinn, NBC News, Des Moines.
Jerden went on to become Carter's White House chief of staff. And during the 4 years of the Carter administration, he worked closely with the president to negotiate the Middle East peace agreement, the Panama Canal Treaty, and the release of the Iranian hostages, which took place on the day that Carter's opponent in the 1980 election, Ronald Reagan, was sworn in as president. Jerden returned to Georgia after his White House days, and while he didn't know it then, he would soon start the second public phase of his career as an advocate for cancer research and a mentor to those who were struggling with cancer. Jerden came to the cause because of his own personal struggles. Starting with a diagnosis of a potentially deadly cancer in the early 1980s, Jerden was diagnosed with cancer 6 times over the next 3 decades. In each case, he fought back against all odds to survive. As he told an audience at the National Press Club back in 2001, those experiences inspired his passionate dedication to helping others with cancer.
Finally, what did I learn as a human being about cancer? Through this journey that Dorothy and I have taken over the past 20 years, I've learned a lot. I've learned that sooner or later in life, everybody in this room is going to get a bad report. And your spouse will get a bad report someday, and your siblings will get bad reports, and your parents may have already gotten bad reports, and God forbid, your children may get bad reports. And when you get that bad report, you will probably come face to face for the first time, just as I did, with my own mortality. My life has never seemed more precious or important to me than those times over the past 15 or 20 years when I was fighting for it. So I never want to be able to simply forget and brush aside these experiences that I've had with cancer, the raw fear of death, because if I'm ever able to just put these in a box and put them away, I will lose the ironic blessing and sense of purpose that cancer has given my own life.
In the long run, cancer caught up with Hamilton Jordan. He died at his Northwest Atlanta home, surrounded by family and close friends, in May 2008. Jordan had been working on a memoir of his early life, off and on for a long time before his death, but he left it unfinished. His children, Kathleen, Hamilton Jr., and Alex, and his widow, Dorothy, decided the book deserved to be completed. Kathleen, who was just 19 when her father died, took on the job of editing the memoir. The family found a publisher, and it was released last fall. It's called A Boy from Georgia, Coming of Age in the Segregated South. Kathleen and her mother, Dorothy, joined me to talk about the book just as it was being released last October. Kathleen Jordan, Dorothy Jordan, I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to have both of you here for Two Way Street. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us. We're so thrilled to be here.
Bill, it's great to be here. Thank you very much, and I'm delighted to be here with Kathleen.
Yeah. Let's talk, before we get into talking about the book itself, Dorothy, give us a little bit of a backstory. Hamilton started working on this book quite a long time before he passed away, yes?
I would say it was easily 10 years before his death, so I would say probably mid-90s. Hamilton always wrote, was always writing and thinking about something and putting his thoughts down. And he spent probably the very early morning hours of every day writing. And so I've probably seen different versions of this for about a decade. And so it's really quite a pleasure to see Kathleen bring it forward.
At what point during that process did he, I mean, he went through a series, obviously, of illnesses, cancers, which he wrote about with such extraordinary eloquence in No Such Thing as a Bad Day. But at what point during this did he learn he had mesothelioma and that he probably was not going to live a lot longer?
Well, in August of 2006, he developed inflammation around his heart, and it was actually quite serious. I would say that he realized he had this disease, mesothelioma, almost a year before he died, so probably May 2007. But he did not accept that he was going to die until about 48 hours before his death. So he was the warrior that, you know, we think of him. I say we, you know, his family and people in the cancer community know Hamilton as a real, you know, knew him as a real fighter and this warrior. And he just had this view of, you know, fighting until you can't fight anymore, and thought he would survive and beat it. Those were his words, were always, I'm going to beat this.
And he kept writing this memoir all through that period.
He did.
Okay. Kathleen, your whole family really got involved in trying to make this book a reality, right?
Definitely. When my dad was dying, we were focused on that, and I don't think that any of us knew that we would go on to finish this book. But then when he died, it kind of was a natural next step for us. It was part of our grieving process. And at one point, Hamilton Jr., my older brother, decided, I'm going to spend a concerted amount of time working on this, and let's see what we can do with it. And it started as something small. I think originally we had planned to just be able to print it ourselves and pass it out to his friends and family. But as we kind of got the ball rolling, we started to get some traction. Hamilton then started going to law school. I was working at Comedy Central, and I quit my job there to take this on full time. I finished the writing. I mean, I didn't tell any new stories in his voice or anything. I just kind of polished some rough edges and moved some things around to make it more of a narrative. It's an excellent read, but when you get to the end, you do get the sense that there could have been more, and he had a lot more that he wanted to say. But the biggest thing that we did was get it published.
Yeah. It's interesting that it ends basically with his getting to know Jimmy Carter. And we'll talk about that as we go along. But let me go to the start of the book. Kathleen, you said that it was your father who picked out the quote that is at the front of the book. And if you don't mind, I'll read it. It's Thomas Wolfe writing about his lost generation. "You belong to it too. You came along at the same time. You can't get away from it. You're a part of it, whether you want to be or not." And what's interesting to me about that quote is it also has something in common with the cover photograph that you've chosen for this book. So let's talk about the quote, but first tell people, describe what the photograph is on the cover of the book.
Sure. It's a photo of young Hamilton. He's holding a Confederate flag, standing in front of his staircase in his childhood home in Albany, Georgia. And he's smiling, and he's just kind of, you get the sense that someone just kind of threw him the flag and said, "Oh, we're taking a photo." And he's holding this thing that now has then had so much weight, and especially now in the last few years has taken on an even greater weight. This photo of him feels like kind of the perfect image for the cover of the book, because it's the story of his journey. He starts by not having a lot of ownership about where he's coming from. And you see in the book, he's gradually, slowly realizing, perhaps more slowly than he's proud to say, would be proud to say now, that a lot of the people in his life that he loved and respected are on the wrong side of history when it comes to segregation and race relations. I think the Thomas Wolfe quote works kind of perfectly. Like you said, they really go hand in hand.
Sure. I mean, he has to embrace who he is.
Right. And he doesn't have a choice. That's where he comes from. And he does come from a community that didn't accept
Brown versus Board of Education.
Yeah. Yeah. It was years before they didn't integrate their high schools and in their middle schools until 1971.
And a lot of the book, and Dorothy, let me bring you in. A lot of the book talks about this journey that your husband took. Your daughter says in the introduction, the manuscript gave her the chance to rethink her Southern heritage. It gave her and her brothers the rare and strange privilege of learning about their father in the past tense and entirely through a new lens. What does that mean to you?
It means a lot. And I have to say that I grew up in the Northeast. And so my first trip down to Albany and South Georgia was very eye-opening. And when my mother met Hamilton's mother, my mother was born in Jersey City and New Jersey, and it was like I almost felt like I needed an interpreter for both of them. But this experience for Hamilton Jr., Kathleen, and Alex has been invaluable for them in really getting to understand where their dad comes from.
So he comes from a very illustrious family that is your family too, obviously. Who were Hamp and Murr, Kathleen?
Hamp and Murr were his maternal grandparents. Hamp McWhorter, Hamilton McWhorter, was an important political figure, and he had a huge role in the Senate, the Georgia State Senate.
He was president of the Senate.
Yes, he was president of the Senate.
Yeah.
And was a big figure in Lexington, Georgia. And he was one of kind of the principal wheelers and dealers of the scene, and had a lot of, there was, when my dad would go visit with his family, he'd go to his grandparents' home and visit in the summers and during holidays. And while he was there, he would see his grandfather, Hamp, kind of greet people at the door and give him a glass of old granddad whiskey and bring him back to smoke cigars and kind of talk politics. And I think that that kind of dressed down way of making things happen was really intoxicating for my dad, and I think really appealing to see that. So that that helped him, I think, get inspired to work in politics.
Yeah, I mean, as the memoir makes clear, Hamp introduced him to politics over and over again. Mm-hmm. I think, in addition to what he saw his grandfather actually doing, meeting with people in the back room at the house in Lexington,
Georgia,
which is out near Athens. Is
mm-hmm.
that right?
That's great.
Okay. In 1952, he was a little boy, and it was the first year that that the political conventions were televised live. And Hamp sat him down, right, Dorothy, mm-hmm. and had him watch the convention with him at his very young age.
And he was mesmerized.
Yeah.
He was mesmerized, hooked. And several times over the years, he talked about the significance of receiving a weekly national news magazine in the mail and how special he felt. And he just, you know, just sat down and read it, you know, front to back, cover to cover.
Time magazine.
Times.
He was
Time
like 8
magazine.
Years old when he got a subscription mm-hmm. from Hamp.
From Hamp, and Hamp. He walked out to his mailbox and saw something addressed to him all the way from New York City. He couldn't even believe how special that was. He was religious about reading it cover to cover, and he ate it up. He lapped it up.
There's a very funny story about a trip to Washington, D.C. I think, like 1954. His first trip to Washington, goes to the Smithsonian Institution and is incredibly excited to find what?
To find that there was a McWhorter that had fought in the war.
In
the Civil War.
And had won the Congressional Medal of Honor?
Exactly. Had won the Congressional Medal of Honor. So he was just beaming with pride when he returned to Georgia to tell his grandfather, Hamp. And in telling it, my dad held back the fact till the very end, punchline, but he was fighting for the North. And Hamp, it sounds like Hamp almost just passed out.
I think he just didn't acknowledge it and then just moved on. Just
right.
Didn't it's talk just, about it anymore.
That's kind of the Southern man's way. I think Southern identity or any kind of identity is complicated. And that's, he's really wrestling with that throughout the book. And I actually think that writing the book was an exercise in all of that. And I don't know that he could have really claimed a lot of these feelings until he'd already written them down. He didn't talk about some of this stuff. You know, it wasn't comfortable for him to talk about. And I think that writing it was the best way for him to express himself.
Let's talk about the episode. Martin Luther King came to Albany. Mm-hmm. And there was a demonstration. It's part of the Albany movement. But your dad went to the march with his father, even though the Albany Herald, the news media, they talked about stay away, there could be riots in the street, communists crawling around Albany. And yet your father went with his father to the demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the beginning of his thinking about the very things you're talking about. Would you read us the passage in the memoir that talks a bit about that? And tell us, if we need a setup, tell us what it would be.
Sure. They saw their maid, Hattie, somebody who they talk to every day, and they specifically don't talk about the things, these race issues. So they had just seen Hattie. My father, a normally gregarious man, watched in silence, then suddenly tugged at my arm and said, "Let's go." I was gripped by the spectacle in front of me and just stood there. I felt another hard tug. "Listen to me, Hamilton. We are leaving," my dad said sternly. "Right now. Do you hear me?" He was silent for a while as we drove away. Then he started talking, angrily. "Those people ought to be ashamed of themselves, getting those children into that mess. I'll be glad when they all leave town." "What about Hattie?" I asked. "Hattie better be careful, or she's going to be looking for work somewhere else." My father harbored no sympathy for the protesters and repeated the argument that the good local colored folks have been brainwashed by these outside agitators. But my father was a gentleman who would never harm another human being. I could tell that he was uncomfortable, even troubled, with what he had seen that day. The ugly mood of the crowd, the raw hate that we could see and hear and almost feel. Reading about the protesters in the local papers, I too felt threatened. These people were apparently out to destroy our way of life. But seeing it up close was entirely different. And witnessing the march that afternoon and seeing the faces of those people quietly fighting for their rights had an impact on me. I felt real shame for the first time in my life, standing by and merely watching while decent people, including our own Hattie, were herded into the alley and treated like animals. Later, I would mark that day as a moment of moral failure in my life. I had an opportunity to take a stand, to risk something. Instead, I had just stood there. And like so many other decent white Southerners, I kept my outrage and my shame to myself. So it's a unique moment. It took something really personal. It took this issue walking right into his front door, or rather, walking right into his back door, for him to really kind of begin to face any of it and his own role in it.
Hamilton might sound like a cliche, but he had the biggest heart of any human being that I know, and he loved people, every person he met, and he could only have an open heart and be generous. And so I'm just thinking about how, you know, how complex all of this was for him as a young boy, wrestling with these feelings and the love for his dad and wanting to follow his father's direction, but at the same time feeling for Hattie and being worried about her. And then the next morning, her coming in and, you know, saying, "How would you like your eggs, Mr. Hamilton?" And, you know, then just moving on like life is normal, when I'm sure he wanted to say, "Hattie, are you okay? You know, what's going on? Is your family okay? What are you thinking about? What does this mean to you?" I'm sure was confused.
And definitely didn't have the opportunity for a dialogue. I'm sure there was no room for conversation.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that would have been appropriate.
If you're just joining us, we're talking today with Kathleen Jordan, the daughter of President Jimmy Carter's White House Chief of Staff, Hamilton Jordan, and Jordan's widow, Dorothy. We recorded our conversation last October at the time of the publication of A Boy from Georgia, Coming of Age in the Segregated South. It's a memoir of Jordan's early life in Albany, Georgia. Back with more in a moment. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. My guests are Dorothy Jordan, the widow of former White House Chief of Staff Hamilton Jordan, and Hamilton's daughter, Kathleen. Jordan died in 2008 without finishing a memoir of his early life in Albany. Kathleen took on the job of editing the book and preparing it for publication. We recorded our conversation in the Two-Way Street studio last fall when the memoir was published. It's called A Boy from Georgia, Coming of Age in the Segregated South. So he got an internship with Richard Russell, where he became a vertical engineer.
Yes, an esteemed vertical engineer.
What does that mean?
AKA he drove the elevator. Basically, he stood
an elevator operator.
Exactly. Right. He stood by the elevator, and basically his main role was on the off chance that a senator came and they needed to get someplace quickly, that he could override the elevator and make sure that the senator got priority. But I mean, in the way that he described the internship to his parents and trying to convince them to let him go, he made it sound as if he was going to be Senator Richard Russell's right-hand man and helping him make very important decisions. But I think we all think that.
He had not had a particularly good semester at the University of Georgia.
No.
His grades were supposed to arrive in the mail before he left for Washington, and he knew that his mother, your grandmother, if she saw the grades that he expected he was going to get, would stop him from going. What did he
do?
Yes,
he intercepted the grades the night before, and he hid it under his pillow, and then the next morning on the way out to D.C., he stuffed it in the mailbox and split.
I think he says in the memoir, doesn't he, that he said to his mother, hey, by the way, if my grades come, when yes. my grades come, make sure you let me know.
Please let me know. I'm so curious to know how I did on my grades. If any of his children had known of his torrid academic past, we would have given him a hard time and maybe not performed as well in school. So
yeah, one of the things he got was a D in algebra, and I think his mother said how
well his mother. I mean, yes, she was
a mathematical genius.
She was. It was amazing when we were back in Albany this past week. I was with my brothers there, and we were speaking to a lot of old friends and neighbors of my dad's and their families. And one of the main points that people wanted to get across was how unbelievably brilliant his mother was. She graduated high school 4 years early, graduated from college, a four-year college, in I think a year and a half, and then was teaching math. She graduated from Agnes Scott, and then she was teaching math. She was a math teacher at a high school and was teaching students who were older than her math. So she was the fact that my dad couldn't really – he couldn't be bothered to make good grades. He was more concerned about his fraternity and his girlfriend and all of that stuff. That was a very, very big disappointment to her.
So the March on Washington took place. It was the summer of 1963 while your dad was working in Richard Russell's office. And he figured out a way to get something of a VIP view of the whole event, right? It started when he answered a telephone call.
Someone called the office. My dad answered the phone. And just by happenstance, there was someone working in the office with the last name Jordan, Bill Jordan. And so someone asked, may I speak to Mr. Jordan? And just for fun, he said, sure, this is he. And they asked if Senator Russell would be sending any delegates to the March on Washington. My dad knew that no one would be there. That they didn't plan to send anybody there because Senator Russell didn't want to get mixed up and all that mess. And so he said, yes, Senator Russell would like to send one of his favorites to the march. And so my dad.
One of his finest and sharpest.
Yes,
aides.
Exactly. a key aide. And so my dad, through trickery, was escorted in a police car to the March on Washington. I think what started as kind of a fun and exhilarating little trick that he played ended up being kind of one of the most important moments of his life.
He describes in the memoir that he was way back in the other end of the reflecting pool when MLK got up, when Dr. King got up to give his I Have a Dream speech. And as Kathleen said, he couldn't really hear the words of that speech, but he knew something important was happening, didn't he?
He did. He witnessed the observers and participants then coming together with a purpose, and I think that he shared that purpose.
He witnessed yet another event that gave him more to think about in
exactly.
terms of that. He went to a rally for when George Wallace was running mm-hmm. for governor. By chance, his next-door neighbor, what was the connection there?
He was dating a girl who had a connection to George Wallace. I think her uncle worked with him, and so she invited him to go to this kind of picnic backyard style rally.
Is there a Lennon. Little piece of the George Wallace?
So he was there, and as he was leaving, he had a kind of a moment to think about what he'd seen that day. As we drove home that afternoon, I reflected on what I had seen and heard. There was something hard, mean, and raw about George Wallace. The reaction of the crowd to Wallace's message was unsettling. They came in happy and left angry, feeling threatened and wanting somebody to do something about it. Even though he'd had this crowd of You Follow Home folks solidly behind him, I didn't think a candidate like George Wallace with just a straight racial appeal could be elected governor of Alabama. Not in the 1960s. 1 year later, George Wallace won the race for governor by a landslide. 4 years later, a man named Lester Maddox, claiming Wallace as his role model and leader, was elected governor of Georgia. I was surprised that these racial undercurrents were so powerful as to cause our citizens to totally ignore a candidate's intelligence, background, and experience when making a voting decision. it was a lesson I'd learn and relearn for years to come.
You know, Dorothy, when I read that section of the book, I thought about today, and notwithstanding the racial element, mm-hmm. but the anger that he saw in that crowd when George Wallace whipped them into a frenzy about how they were being treated, how life was not going in their favor around them. It's reminiscent of what we're seeing in the presidential campaign right now, isn't it?
Absolutely, with just glib, broad statements without any substance. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah. So what's interesting, too, about Hamilton's journey is that while he was witness to a lot of events that helped him understand racial injustice and prejudice, there was another kind of prejudice that he became aware of and was surprised by. Who were the Gottheimers?
Let me read you a little section.
Okay.
So my dad was in college when he got a call that his grandmother had died, somebody that he loved and respected a great deal. And so he made arrangements and drove to her funeral. Murr, just as a reminder, Hamp was her husband. So here's a little section about this. My eyes wandered as we waited for Hamp. Less than 5 yards to the right of Murr's burial site, I couldn't help but notice a large, weathered family marker with the name Gottheimer chiseled into the stone. Two dark, long slabs lay side by side in front of this marker. The writing on the slabs was not easy to read, but I could clearly make out the name Gottheimer at the top and the word Germany in the inscriptions on both. I had never seen nor heard that name before. It sure looked German to me, and it sure sounded Jewish to me. Standing just behind me was one of my Uncle Hamilton's oldest and dearest friends from childhood, Cliff Brooks. I turned and whispered in his ear, "Cliff, who are those Jews buried next to my grandmother?" Cliff looked surprised at my question. After looking around, Cliff cupped his hand over his mouth, leaned forward, and whispered quietly in my ear, "Those are Miss Helen's parents." Then, after a pause, he added, "Your great-grandparents." I was stunned. My great-grandparents? The Gottheimers? How could that be? I had never even heard the name before. My mind was spinning. Who were these people? It sure sounded Jewish to me.
And they were.
Yes.
And it was a family secret. There's a supposition he makes in writing the memoir, a supposition he'd always wondered why Hamp, who was such a successful political leader in the state Senate, didn't run for governor. There was some secret that must be behind his decision not to run.
We imagine, and it seems pretty clear, that Hamp didn't ever run for governor because his wife was Jewish.
So do we suppose then that that made him unelectable? Or do we think perhaps he didn't want this to be discussed?
Yeah,
clearly it wasn't discussed in the family.
It's a good question. All. Yeah, mm-hmm. They didn't talk about it in the family at all. Dad talked to his mom and asked her, he tried to get her to talk about it a few times. She would almost talk and then she'd start doing something else, or she'd say, "I just can't talk about this right now." And then she finally asked him to just stop asking. Yeah, that is a good question, Mom.
How did Hamilton talk to you about this?
Hamilton was proud of, he considered himself Jewish. And
well, I mean, by Jewish law, he was Jewish.
He did. And that was what. And so, and certainly, you know, we clearly have many friends that are Jewish, and that would always be a topic of conversation. Somehow, somewhere into the dinner or whatever.
Oh, I'm a Jew too.
He said, "I'm a Jew too." Did you know that I'm a Jew too?
It's like, yeah. Oh, really? What's the Torah? No, I mean, he didn't know a lot about being Jewish. But
he was intrigued by this. He was intrigued.
We'll have more with Kathleen and Dorothy Jordan after a break. This is Two-Way Street. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. We're talking today about former White House Chief of Staff Hamilton Jordan. My guests are Dorothy Jordan, Hamilton's widow, and his daughter, Kathleen. Kathleen took on the task of editing a memoir her father was writing about his early life in Albany, Georgia, at the time of his death. I talked with the Jordans when the book was published last October. Let's talk about a couple more things. Hamilton apparently is intended to continue writing this memoir.
One aspect of this book that didn't get across the finish line because there wasn't enough there, but was something that my dad wanted to discuss, was he started speaking with, and I didn't know this until recently, but he started speaking in his research for the book and in the last few years of his life, started speaking with different people that were out, that were gay in Albany, people that he grew up with that would later be out. And that's a whole other
discrimination.
That was right. Occurring. A whole other kind of discrimination that obviously that's obviously still super relevant today, as are all of these other
issues.
Did you
imagine he was going to write about that in some way?
He was going to write about it. He started some writing about it.
Okay.
But it just, there wasn't enough there to include it in this.
So let's tell the story of, broad strokes of his meeting Jimmy Carter, because it's really a terrific story. How did it happen?
He wrote Jimmy Carter a letter.
Where was Hamilton at that time? He was a student still?
Yes, he was a student still. And he wrote Jimmy Carter a letter. He'd seen him speak once. He didn't think he was a great speaker, but he thought he was okay, and he was looking for a job. So he wrote him a letter saying that he was interested in working for him. And then a month or so passed, and Jimmy Carter called my dad and said, "Hamilton, I got your letter. I'd really like for you to come work for me." And my dad said, "Oh, it's so nice. Thanks for calling. But I already have a job spraying mosquitoes this summer, so I don't really think I'm going to be able to bow out on that." And Jimmy Carter said, if spraying mosquitoes is more important to you than me being elected governor, then, you know, maybe I should try to find a different job.
maybe I shouldn't run for governor.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's a pretty funny story.
He did work for him in that first gubernatorial race, which Jimmy mm-hmm. Carter lost.
Correct. And then he decided to run again, and he won. My dad was one of the chief architects of that campaign, and then later his presidential campaign.
Let's talk for a couple minutes. You write very movingly in your afterword about being with your dad the last few days of his life. And Dorothy, before Kathleen reads a section of that, I've heard stories about the last few days, and it seems to me that there was an amazing kind of peacefulness around your house and this, despite what you were all dealing with, knowing that Hamilton was about to die. Is that correct?
I think that is correct, in that he definitely was at peace. And so that clearly was important. And he accepted and acknowledged that there was no cure, no hope.
And in a way that was of some comfort and help to you all, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I think, Bill, one of the most difficult things for myself and the kids and everyone who loved Hamilton, and there were many of us, was to see him continue to wage this battle that from the sidelines, from my sideline, I didn't see him being able to win the war that he was waging so valiantly. And personally, I regretted his expenditure of energy towards that. And that's a very, probably a selfish thing to say. I wanted him to be focusing more on the people that he loved and expending more energy in what they were doing. Kathleen had just started college. Alex was still in high school. And I understand. I understand intellectually, you know, where he was, and I can understand where he was emotionally, that was his purpose every day, was to fight. And
he fought all of his illnesses and
absolutely
conquered them.
Yes.
His book, No Such Thing as a Bad Day, is one of the most profound statements I've ever read about conquering fear, insisting on life.
Insisting. Yeah. And he insisted on winning this war. And so he was at home, and he would take naps off and on throughout the day. And he woke up from a nap and said to me, "I see now that there's no use in fighting anymore." and I'm going to die now. And so that was so Hamilton in that meaning that, he wanted to be the director and wanted to be the strategist. And so he had determined that it came to him in his sleep. He described a dream that it was time for him to die. And Hamilton Jr., our oldest, was a musician at the time and was actually traveling in Europe doing music festivals, and he was performing. And just somehow, some way, the band had one phone, and it happened to be in Hamilton's pocket, and it happened to be turned on when, that was at a time, that was in 2008. Everyone didn't necessarily have cell phones with international service. So he picked up the phone, and I said, come home. Yeah. And so he survived. He made it.
Kathleen, you describe in the end of the book a moment that you had with your father. Would you read it to us?
Absolutely. Our father's last living lesson to us was, ironically, in dying. He did a damn good job of it. In May 2008, he announced that it was time, and it was. We sat with him in groups and individually during those final days. He'd drift in and out of consciousness. I never knew when he closed his eyes if he had died, and I told him that. Dad, I don't even know if you're dead or not, I said softly. He smiled and held his middle finger up to me. Once he had been sleeping for a while when he suddenly sat up with a surprising energy. Cautious of any and every inconsistency, I asked, are you okay? What's wrong? Straight-faced, he said, I have to pee or die. I told him that either way would relieve the feeling. We laughed at our poignancy and he fell back to sleep.
Here's a guy who went from a little boy in Albany, Georgia, to chief of staff of the White House, and then beyond. And I think, like Jimmy Carter, and I want to get your reaction, both of you, I think there's an interesting parallel between your dad. In some ways, both of them reached their greatest success after their White House years. And so with that in mind, what does all of this mean to you, Kathleen? What does it mean to have had Hamilton Jordan as your father? And what do you take away? What does his life teach you?
Oh, that's a big question. Working on this book has been a kind of a slow process of getting to understand my dad's place in the world, kind of not related to me, but I've also learned a lot of lessons through that. It's been a way for me to talk to him after he's died. He was such a loving, compassionate person. It's funny, I directed a book trailer for this book a few weeks ago, or about a week ago, and asked everybody in my immediate family that question, what was the best quality about Hamilton, our dad? And no one was in the same room at the time, but every single person's answer was his compassion, his big heart, and his love for people. And that is something that I really take with me every day, and I really try to live that because that's such a challenge, I think. It's so easy to fall into patterns of just, judging people and deciding that it's more fun to talk about somebody's, embarrassments or problems or mistakes than it is to wake up every day and choose to love with an open heart and be the best version of yourself that you can be. I guess that's a long-winded way of saying that what it means for my dad to have been my dad. I still think of him as my dad first, not a political figure, not necessarily the boy even in this book. I think about him as my dad, and what I learned from him was that compassion and that love, and it is something that I work towards every day.
Dorothy, so for you, having gone through this extraordinary experience with him post White House, but then watching the rest of his life, what's that left for you?
Well, to jump on what Kathleen said, I feel like Hamilton was able to, in his work, following working with President Carter, do what meant the most to him, which was making a difference in someone's life. And whether that meant getting up from the dinner table because he got a call that someone was newly diagnosed and he had some information about a treatment or a particular center, treatment center that he should go to, or whether that meant coaching Alex's t-ball team. He had the ability in his life removed from politics, if you will, to connect with people daily and make a difference. Yeah. Daily. And I think that's how we try to raise our children, is that's the most important thing you can do in your life, is connect with your fellow human beings and care about them.
Kathleen and Dorothy, I cannot tell you what a pleasure it's been to have had you here. Thank you so much for coming in for Two Way Street. The book is A Boy from Georgia. We will post a link to the website about the book. We're also going to post a link. I found a speech on YouTube that Hamilton gave to an institute in Florida, and it's really a beautiful talk about it, talking about cancer, dealing with cancer. So we'll post a link to that so people can learn a little more about Hamilton. Thanks both for being here very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Bill.
I've been talking with Dorothy Jordan and Kathleen Jordan about the publication of a posthumous memoir written by former Jimmy Carter White House Chief of Staff Hamilton Jordan. It's called A Boy from Georgia, Coming of Age in the Segregated South. One of the great ironies of Hamilton's life is that even before he got his own cancer diagnosis, he was introduced to the devastating impact the disease can have, especially on children. He learned through Dorothy. She'd worked as a nurse caring for children with cancer. In the early 1980s, she created Camp Sunshine in the North Georgia Mountains. It was one of the country's first camps for children with cancer. And over the years, it's expanded from one-week summer sessions to year-round activities for children and their families. It was Dorothy's passion, but Hamilton quickly embraced it too. And so when it came time to eulogize Hamilton at a memorial service that took place at the Carter Center in May 2008, Jimmy Carter spoke not only of his longtime advisor and friend's political skills, but of his compassion too.
I wouldn't really say that the big shots in Washington gave us very much of a welcome. Our Georgia Mafia, as it was called by others, not us, exhibited a lot of irreverent wit, a lack of deference for titles and pomposity and artificiality, and we sometimes found ourselves separated from those who felt that they ran our national capital. I remember that once Speaker Tip O'Neill called me in the Oval Office and I asked him what I could do for him. He said, "I would like for you to go down the hall and ask Hamilton Jordan to return my call." And I said, "Yes, sir, Mr. Speaker. Have you already called him?" And he said, "Yes, I've called him, but he's sometimes late in returning my calls." And I said, "Okay, I will deliver the message, Mr. Speaker. If I can find Hamilton this afternoon." Hamilton was the unquestioned coordinator of our entire staff. Not because he was anointed by me to be chief of staff, but because everybody else in the White House knew that Hamilton was their chief. He was a driving force behind the Panama Canal treaties, the Middle East peace process, the safe return of the hostages from Iran, and every other good thing that we ever attempted or accomplished while in Washington. His political skills were legendary. That's been mentioned several times up here. Later, as we all know, Hamilton helped tens of thousands of cancer patients, not just through his book, but directly in person, and many others who thought they had a death sentence, strengthened them and inspired them with his own courageous example. He was as gentle and courageous and compassionate as anyone I have ever known, and his blessings will live forever in my life, and then the other lives that he has touched. I loved Hamilton like my own son, and I will miss him for the rest of my life.
Jimmy Carter speaking at the memorial service for Hamilton Jordan in 2008. We're going to post a number of links related to today's show on our Two-Way Street Facebook page. We'll point you to the video of the memorial service at which Jimmy Carter and so many others eulogized Hamilton. And we'll have a link to the funny and moving speech Jordan gave about cancer at the National Press Club back in 2001. Remember, if you can't be near a radio when we're on the air, you can listen to Two-Way Street whenever you want by downloading the GPB Atlanta mobile app. You'll find Two-Way Street, Political Rewind, On Second Thought with Celeste Headlee, and all your favorite NPR shows there. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. That's it for this week's show. Our producer is Jenny Ament. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for being with us. I hope to see you again next week for another edition of Two-Way Street.